WCFW HD2 Chippewa Falls, W228 EP Eau Claire,
and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
CBS News Brief. The jury in the federal trial of hip-hop mogul Sean Diddy Combs will return for a third day of deliberations tomorrow after telling the judge it reached a partial verdict in the case. Legal analyst Thane Rosenbaum.
The jury knows him to be a music and fashion mogul, but they may not reach agreement on him being a godfather of freak-offs.
The Senate passes to the House President Trump's tax and spending bill with some changes that have been made. It narrowly passed the Senate. Republican Congressman Chip Roy of Texas says of higher deficits.
I've not heard one person irrefutably tell me that there are not going to be higher deficits over the next 5 years.
Heat warnings have been issued for parts of Spain, Italy, and the UK. In Germany, it was 98 degrees, especially tough for those who work outside, like this woman.
It's quite hard for us engineers and for our workers. We try as much as we can to stay safe, firstly for ourselves, and after for our work.
CBS News Brief, I'm Jennifer Kuiper.
Download the Civic Media app in the Google Play or Apple App Store and take us everywhere. This is the Civic Media Radio Network.
Big changes for the Bucks. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Milwaukee Bucks making some record moves in free agency. They waived Damian Lillard, who suffered that torn Achilles tendon. Lillard, who turns 35 later this month, will be paid $22.5 million over the next 5 years in dead money by the Bucks owners. GM John Horst then making a deal to acquire Indiana Pacers center Miles Turner, a four-year deal worth $107 million. Turner is 29 years old. He'll replace 37-year-old Brooke Lopez, who will sign a two-year contract with the LA Clippers. To get under the salary cap, the Bucks had to trade guard Pat Connaughton and two future second-round picks to the Charlotte Hornets in exchange for Vasilije Micic, a 31-year-old guard from Serbia. And Milwaukee will also sign 11-year veteran guard Gary Harris of the Orlando Magic. Again, Damian Lillard, no longer with the Bucks. Baseball, the Brewers and the Mets rained out tonight in New York. They'll play a split doubleheader tomorrow. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
This is what I love, Madison. There's so many weird things. Bennett's Meadowood Country Club, which is a bar and not a country club, they have an event called Smut and Eggs. You show up for eggs and you watch a porn film while you eat breakfast. I have trouble watching a PG-13 movie when I eat breakfast. It's more of a dinner thing, I think.
Yeah.
Maybe a nice group orgy and some pasta.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba. Weeknights from 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. 93.5 The Tap.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. Not going to spend time talking about what's going on with Iran, because we don't know. I don't trust anything this administration has to say. I think this is a huge mistake in my view. I think we could have potentially opened up Pandora's box, but look, it may be a wild success. Who knows? At this point, I am staying a little bit away from it until we know more. And I know that's hard to hear, but understand, I oppose the idea from the beginning, think it's a bad idea. But that said, more into something that I think is interesting. And I'm sure over the weekend, everyone talked about Trump's recent statement that there are too many non-working holidays. And interestingly enough, a number of my Red Hat friends regurgitated the same thing. Because they're federal holidays. Understand, federal holidays. A lot of them, they don't get those days off. And that's the interesting part of that statement, because he understands it. He understands how to play the division card. You know, I can pay half the working class to murder the other half. You got federal workers, because this is part of the war on federal workers. The federal workers, they get those days off. Like Juneteenth, oddly enough, made the comment on Juneteenth, which had a lot of folks going, there's a racial tinge to it. I don't know. I don't doubt it. But it is interesting that that's when it came out. Now, he claims that it cost the country billions of dollars because, you know, we're shutting everything down and, you know, and workers don't really want it. I don't know. Understand, the U.S. has, I think, if my research is come somewhat close to right, the U.S. actually has fewer paid holidays and, of course, no statutory minimum for paid vacation when you compare it to other developed countries. Understand, and I remember the first time that I heard it, workers in Germany get a month's vacation to start. I met a guy in Cancun who said he had just started 6 months with a company, got 2 weeks vacation to go to Cancun to go scuba diving because he's working a little hard. Now, understand, it's like anything. Too many federal holidays, which, again, we're probably the lowest in the industrialized world. Too many, sure, could cause productivity losses, slowdowns, all kinds of stuff. But again, we don't. And what's interesting to me is, you know, we've told ourselves for decades now, we're number one. We're the top of everything. When the reality is the working class of this country is struggling significantly with standard of living, life expectancy, happiness. You know, the bottom 60% of households in this country, they're struggling just to keep food on the table, a roof over their head. Wages have not kept up with inflation, and yet they're the ones struggling. Healthcare costs, transportation. You know, again, we're bombing Iran, and what do you think is going to happen to gas prices? The federal minimum wage is a poverty wage. If you work full-time at minimum wage, you are in poverty. Life expectancy. We used to say, hey, look at us with all these great technologies. The average life expectancy in this country right now is 79.4 years. That's lower than other wealthy countries who on average 82 and a half years. So we're losing a couple of years. Why? Well, a bunch of reasons. Healthcare being a big part of it. And now that we're going to go after slash and burn part of Medicaid, you poor people probably going to die a lot sooner. And that other thing we like to talk about, because I say it all the time, life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. That's basically where I come down on most issues. The happiness index, the U.S. doesn't rank in the top of any of the global happiness indexes. In fact, many Americans report lower well-being compared to citizens in countries that have much stronger social safety nets and less economic inequality. We are one of the most unequal countries on the planet. And yet, we keep telling ourselves how wonderful we are. Because look, this is policy. This is politics. So while we're fighting over somebody went to the bathroom or you name the idiot issue that they shoved down our throats. What we're not focused on is lower standard of living, shorter life expectancy, and less happiness. That's the reality. And for me, those are the issues that are important. So when I have people who go, well, what about this? I go, you know, I'd rather talk about how screwed up our tax code is. Oh, there's nothing sexy about that. There's nothing to really get outraged other than working people are getting stiffed at every turn. We have created the largest billionaire class in the history of humanity. And what do we have to show for it? Well, we're going to blow a bunch of things up in the Middle East. I guess we're going to go do that again. But do we have the best education, the best health care, the best infrastructure, the best opportunities for our citizens? Have we eradicated homelessness or hunger? Have we done anything that matters? And, you know, it's interesting. I saw a clip with Jerry Seinfeld. And he said, you know, in the 70s, nobody cared about wealth. And he said, you know, he was, hey, how cool was my job? We're now fixated on a billionaire class and trying to make them even wealthier at our expenses. We're going to continue to tighten our belts so that they can have more. Yeah, we're the wealthiest country in the history of humanity at its wealthiest moment. And yet we've got children who go to bed hungry. We've got veterans who sleep on the street. We've got people with mental illness who aren't getting treatment. We've got families who are struggling every day just to make it till tomorrow. And yet we're fighting over nonsense. And that's the mastery of Trump. That's the mastery of the Republican Party. That's the mastery of a political machine funded by and owned by big business and the extraordinarily wealthy. Because they got us talking about stuff, you know, that in the grand scheme of things, doesn't really change our lives or affect our lives. All the while, they're picking our pockets. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, Bobby Kogan's going to be here from the Center for American Progress. Share some thoughts on the big, beautiful nightmare bill. Back after this.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So interesting couple of days as Republicans are losing their minds over the Senate parliamentarian basically saying, no, you can't cut SNAP. You can't reimburse border states for your big, beautiful wall. No money to move the shuttle Discovery over to the Johnson Space Center. No. And Republicans don't like no. And on Monday, the Senate Republicans were supposed to release their part of the big nightmare. Didn't happen. Kind of makes you wonder. And here to share some thoughts on, well, what we know thus far and where things may go, I've asked Bobby Kogan to come share some thoughts. He's the Senior Director of Federal Budget Policy at the Center for American Progress. Check out their website, AmericanProgress.org. Bobby, thanks for taking time for us.
Rick, thanks so much for having me back on.
So are we surprised that the Senate parliamentarian, who we've only heard her name a couple of times over the last couple of decades, are we surprised by this?
I would say some of the rulings that she's been handing down were what we were expecting. We were expecting her to say, no, you can't do the RAINS Act. No, you can't give the president the ability to reorganize entire departments. No, you can't stop courts from issuing contempt orders or anything like that. Some of the other stuff, though, was pretty surprising. I would say Democrats have been doing basically nearly as well a job as one could have expected. Democrats won on Republicans defunding CFPB, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Republicans wanted to completely eliminate its funding, and Democrats won on not only completely eliminating it, but even partially eliminating its funding. Democrats won on the state share for SNAP, making they were going to make states cover a significant portion of the cost that could have risked some states dropping out of the SNAP program entirely. Democrats won on that, too. I would say Democrats have basically been dominating these birdbaths.
And, you know, as I've been reading these stories, and there have been a bunch of them, my mind, you know, keeps going to this point of I'm waiting for Republicans to finally say, the heck with it. We're laws be damned, rules be damned. I'm waiting for the filibuster to go by the wayside. I'm waiting for Trump to say, screw the courts. I'm going to do whatever I want. I'm waiting for her to get axed and them to do whatever they want in this bill.
Yeah. So in 2001, when Republicans, this whole process is going through something known as budget reconciliation. What's special about reconciliation is you can avoid a filibuster. Normally in the House, if you have a majority, you can do whatever you want. But in the Senate, it takes 60 votes. And it's not so common that a single party has 60% of the Senate. In reconciliation, as long as you stick to the rules, you can do it with only 51 votes. And in 2001, Republicans fired the parliamentarian for giving advice that they didn't like. So obviously the current parliamentarian over reconciliation when they were trying to do the Bush tax cuts. So obviously the current parliamentarian Elizabeth McDonough has that in the back of her mind. The other thing that I think we might be looking at is Republicans narrowly ignoring her, right? So what she, we always say she rules, but really what she does is she advises the Senate, hey, here's what I think the rules are. And the presiding officer, the person sitting in the chair with the gavel, who in this case will be Vice President J.D. Vance, always has the option to say, thank you. I appreciate your advice. My interpretation is different and I'm going to ignore you. And Republicans have actually been low-key signaling the intent to do that on a specific narrow provision on whether their tax cuts can be deemed to be free or not. Republicans, in addition to doing the largest Medicaid cuts in history and largest SNAP cuts in history, they also are doing enormous tax cuts and increasing the deficit by trillions of dollars, despite the fact that they're taking away from the poorest Americans. But that makes them feel sad, so they want to pretend the tax cuts are free. And whether or not they are allowed to officially pretend they're free instead of just rhetorically pretend they're free, that is a debate before the parliamentarian. And Republicans have basically signaled that if she says no, they will just ignore her.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that I would debate with you over is them feeling bad. I don't think there's a feel bad bone in any of their bodies to take, you know, snap food away from children or you know, Medicaid away from granny, so we kick people out of nursing homes. In fact, you know, in my state of Pennsylvania, there have been a number of nursing homes closed, which is why it's much harder for especially low income seniors to find nursing care. I don't think they care one bit. That's just my opinion, but I don't believe they care even one little bit. So that whole
I agree with you. I was saying they feel bad about the deficit part. I agree with you. They totally support the substance of what they're doing, but they don't, they want to claim at the same time that they're not increasing the deficit. And that's the area where they're doing their biggest pretending.
But even that, I mean, we've seen that. Have we not seen this movie before? Has this not been what's happened a number of times over our lifetimes? You go back to Reagan, the tax reform bill of 86. You go back to W. You go back to Trump's nightmare from 1718. It's all been the same song and dance. These tax cuts are going to pay for themselves. Yeah, off the backs of poor people.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, if you look at the response to the Reagan tax cuts and the deficits they were enormous cuts to low-income programs and programs that help working-class Americans. And then the response to the Bush tax cuts came additional cuts, and the response to the Trump tax cuts came in this, not low-income, but additional spending cuts that were forced in the Biden era and under threat of, you know, maybe forcing the government to default. And this one would be the same way. So obviously agree, but they rhetorically felt the need to pretend, and that's one that they seem willing to completely ignore the parliament.
So what you're saying is it makes them be able to go on Fox News, and or any of the other right wing blather machines, and sell this narrative, so that working class people who consume this garbage, will be able to go, oh, they said it wasn't going to hurt anybody, until it actually hurts those people sitting in those chairs.
Yeah, that's precisely right. This helps them with their entire frame. It helps them so much, helps them both internally with their caucus and their frame to everyone. It's so important to them that they are willing to ignore the parliamentarian, something that is incredibly uncommon, if they don't get their way in this.
Yeah, I've had a number of people ask me, because early on I said it was my hope that they would get so mired in fighting each other and Freedom Caucus saying no deficits and maybe more than one Thomas Massey, that maybe nothing gets done. I'm becoming more and more leery of my hope of that. Any chance nothing gets done? Any chance that this flops? Any chance there? Or is this already a done deal in your thought? They're just trying to figure out how to dance around.
I don't think it's a done deal. I think that it is much more likely than not that this thing passes. But I just say in 2017, when Republicans were trying to repeal the ACA, it really looked like a done deal. Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski were open nose, and John McCain was dying and off doing treatment. And without John McCain there, they couldn't go forward. And then he flew into town, and everyone assumed he was going to vote yes, because why on earth would you fly into town to vote no when just not even being there counts as a no? And so we all assumed it was going to pass when he flew into town. And then he voted yes on the motion to proceed. He voted yes on the motion to proceed. And so we all were really sure. And then sure enough, the whole thing died. So I would just say it's not a done deal. People should reach out. People should speak up. People should call their senators. People has to go back to the House. People should call their members of representatives. People should call their governors, who their Republican governors, who have, you know, close connections with the senators and with the members of Congress. And the governors are going to be feeling a lot of the brunt of this, because a lot of costs will be pushed onto states, and it'll cause a lot of, like, rural hospitals to close and everything. The governors are not actually very happy about this. So there is a lot to be done. It's an uphill battle, but it's worth it, because, I mean, by independent estimates, a conservative estimate is that about 14,000 people will die each year from this who would otherwise not die. Why? Well, it'll kick over 10 million people off their health insurance. You take over 10 million people off their health insurance, some of those people are going to get extremely sick and not be covered anymore. Some of those people are going to be able to pay out of pocket, but some of them won't. And of those people who couldn't afford to get any treatment now, some of them will get so sick that they will die. Like, that's, you know, it's basic logic. And that's right. That's a conservative estimate, only 14,000 people a year.
Yeah, but those are poor people. Those are, you know, if you listen to the rhetoric that I hear coming out, there are certain people we don't need, you know, like homeless people, for instance. And, you know, coming up later in the hour, we're going to talk about, coming up on the year anniversary of the Grants Pass decision. We clearly don't care about poor people, homeless people, children, or this bill wouldn't look as bad as it is.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it is... Quite literally, this bill would make the poorest people in America poorer while making the richest people in America richer. According to the Congressional Budget Office, which is kind of the neutral research group for Congress on budget and economic stuff, analysis, they estimated that the House passed version would make on average the bottom 30% of America poorer. But if you include the effect of Trump's tariffs, Yale Budget Lab kind of mash the tariff effect on. They say if you include the effect of tariffs, the bottom 80% of America is worse off. The next 10% are basically flat. It's only the top 10% of America who does better. So quite literally, the Trump agenda makes almost all of America much poorer and makes the rich richer.
Well, isn't that the plan? Isn't that reason you've got people like Elon Musk spending so much money getting these folks elected? This is why there's such frustration in the country with our political system, because I think now, you know, the cat's out of the bag. I think we all know that the only people that really matter are the folks who can write the big checks.
Yeah, I mean, the more people learn about this bill, the more they hate it. That's true for Democrats. That's true for independents. That's true for Republicans. And there's a longstanding, it's really great. Sometimes when you, there have been a lot of focus groups and everything that share this, that when you explain to Republican voters in plain words describing what a Republican plan is, they assume you're lying, because they say, well, no way would someone actually support this. But it turns out that their elected officials do, and then just lie to them about it, right? You know, they say, oh, well, we're not kicking anyone off of Medicaid. We're only going after the moochers. Oh, no one is actually going to be hurt by this. Oh, no, actually, this helps the poor more than the rich. You know, give me a break, right? This literally would give twice as big a tax cut to people who make $1 million a year than to the bottom half of America combined, right? And they say that it helps the poor more than the rich, right? They're just lying about what they're doing, and some people eat it up.
And this is where, I keep coming back to our media structure. I keep coming back to, the fact that you've got the Fox Newses and the mouthpieces for corporate America, who I don't even know that this is good for them either so much, because if you're pulling all of this demand out of the economy, you're taking money away from Medicaid, you're taking money out of SNAP, you're taking money out of investing in a whole bunch of things. I don't know how it's good for them really either, other than, you know, they got the short-term tax cash to put in their pocket, the windfall. But I don't know how this helps us. I don't know how this makes us as a country better. And I sure don't buy the whole, you know, we're a Christian nation and we care about the children and we're pro-life. I don't buy any of that garbage, but I don't know how it helps us.
Yeah, it's funny that you say that, because the Congressional Budget Office similarly found that this would eventually harm the economy. They found it, the Yale Budget Lab found it, Penn Wharton group, or, you know, basically is a center right group, also found that this would just harm the economy in the long run, right? And in harming the economy, it actually makes even more people worse off, right? By kind of giving people worse, you know, worse negotiating power, making the labor market softer, therefore you get lower raises and everything. The long-term effect of all of this is just a poorer America. Yeah. And so much poorer, I just want to be clear, so much poorer that even with your tax cut, which, by the way, is only $14 per week for the average household making below 100K, it's $14 per week is the tax cut they're getting, whereas the richest folks are getting, you know, 300 grand a year or whatever. Despite that, you end up poorer in the long run because your wage gains have been lower. That's not according to me. That's according to the Congressional Budget Office.
Whoa, hold on, hold on. Just yesterday, I talked about the White House put out a press release, said that, wage growth in the working class hasn't been higher in the last 60 years. It's the highest right now that it has been in 60 years. They put out the press release. It's got to be true.
Yeah, it's got to be true. So funny, you know, in
the it was on the internet. It was on the internet, Bobby.
They couldn't put it on the internet if it weren't true. Last time Trump was president, wage gains basically really picked up at the end of 2015. It took basically after the Great Recession, wages were pretty stagnant because workers had no negotiating power. You asked for more money, and if you were lucky enough to have a job, your job said, good luck somewhere else if you can find a job. But eventually the labor market got strong enough that wages could start going up again. That started, if you look at the trend, it really began in late 2015 and really just continued. And then when Trump passed his tax cuts for the rich, he took credit for this wage gain that had started years before it was passed. In fact, under the previous president, Trump said, aha, it was my tax cuts that did this. It's amazing their time-traveling power that they have.
But again, you know, I keep coming back to, they've got a media structure. They've got an empire. They're in working class ears, in their eyes. It's what they consume. So the lies and the misrepresentation and, you know, just the basic, you know, BS narratives, that's all they get. And this is where I keep coming back to. We need better media in this country.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, you cannot make someone consume information they don't want to consume. And also at the same time, you can't make people report on stuff that they don't want to report on. We have a money incentive structure for a lot of media. And also we have an attention span issue for a lot of consumers of information. I think you put those together and we're in a pretty tough place.
Yeah, I got to think, you know, those kitchen table economic issues are pretty important. You know, talking about granny getting kicked out of a nursing home or stealing food out of the mouths of children. Look, if I were someone who was easily offended, that would offend me. Don't care where someone goes to the bathroom, but if you're starving kids and you're taking food out of the schools, never mind. Last question I've got for you. I know we already talked about this, but marching orders on how maybe you make this less bad or stop it altogether. What do we do?
Yeah, so parts of the less bad, there are more bird baths to be happening, right? That is where they're fighting before the Senate parliamentarian. Democrats have been doing well. The staff have just really been crushing it. And we expect more good victories to make it slightly less bad. I do want to be clear, even with all of our enormous victories, it is still a bill that will be the largest Medicaid cuts ever and the largest SNAP cuts ever, but it is less bad. So more of that to happen. And then I would just say the right thing to do is to reach out to your representatives. They need to hear from you. This is, you know, this is the week of action. And not just your senators. I really mean, call back the House of Representatives. The House passed it assuming that it would change in the Senate. They say, okay, well, this will look different. I'm just going to the next step for now. But if it passes the Senate and goes back to the House, then it is for real. And they need to hear again, no, I really, really, really don't want to lose my Medicaid. I don't want to lose my staff. And I would just say to every single person listening right now, I guarantee you, you know someone who would be hurt by this. I guarantee you. It might be you. It might be someone in your family. It might be someone on your block. And it might be someone in your extended network. but I guarantee you every single person knows someone who would be hurt by this. And just to give one example, when Georgia did Medicaid work requirements, they got a poster, you know, the governor got a poster child, someone who was on Medicaid, who worked really hard, called all the other Medicaid recipients, moochers, and said, this is great. I think this is how it should work. That guy got kicked off his Medicaid twice within under a year when Georgia did Medicaid work requirements. He no longer supports the program because he sees that these things are disasters. So I guarantee you, you know, people you know be hurt, and you owe it to them. You owe it to the people who you know, and you owe it to the people who you will never meet.
Or you owe it to yourself, Bobby. Look, any one of us could run on hard times and need this vital social safety net program. Any one of us. Bobby Kogan, I appreciate the time. Senior Director of Federal Budget Policy there at the Center for American Progress. Thanks so much.
Rick, thanks so much for having me on.
Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Do you see maybe how this could affect you? Do you want to have this social safety net in case? I think it's kind of important. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Back after this.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap Eau Claire, Chippewa Valley's home for the Todd Allball Show.
Local news, weather, and sports on air and streaming on the Civic Media app. This is the Civic Media Radio Network.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Mostly clear tonight, a low in the low 60s. Partly sunny for tomorrow, maybe a stray storm, a high to the upper 80s. And near 90 on Thursday, another slight storm chance. A couple of storms around for the 4th of July and temps in the upper 80s and muggy. Currently at 77.
The Maggie Dawn Show.
Madam Mayor Satya Rhodes Conway from the fabulous city of Madison.
A lot of people say, I don't like politics. It's all dirty and angry and blah, blah, blah. It's really about caring about your community, finding a way to like bring it back to people talking to each other.
Yeah.
About what is important in our place and how do we take care of each other and use the levers of government to do that. That's really what it's about.
The award-winning Maggie Dawn Show at its new time, weekdays 4 till 6 p.m.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So as I talked about the other day, you know, we've all had those moments where we have brushes with either being accused of being homeless or, you know, people who actually are. And my latest... and I talked about this extensively the other day. My latest brush with it was my wife just wanted to get a nap. And we were at the doctor's office, the doctor's facility, and there was a couch and she was laying down. That's all it was. We were just sitting there laying down and three times accosted by just people coming by going, what are you doing here? Do you live here? It was surreal. And to think that, you know, just average everyday working people have taken it upon themselves to really just harass people for no reason kind of gets me. But here's the thing. We're coming up on the 1 year anniversary of the Supreme Court deciding that being homeless is now can be criminal. And here to share some thoughts on what this last year has been like, I've asked Jesse Rabinowitz to come talk with us. Jesse's the campaign and communications director with Homeless Law, their website, homelesslaw.org. Jesse. Thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks so much for having me, Rick. As you mentioned, this Saturday is the 1 year anniversary of the Grants Pass decision when the Supreme Court said that cities and states and even the federal government are allowed to arrest, ticket, fine people experiencing homelessness for just being outside, even if they have nowhere else to go. And it's incredibly shameful. And the past year has proven how disastrous this decision has been.
Yeah, and to be honest, look, I've always been an advocate for sane laws to help homeless folks, to get, you know, people shelter, to get them jobs, to get the services and the things that they need. In fact, for a number of years, we used to do a Hungry and Homeless for the holiday event where we'd live in the supermarket parking lot to raise money, food, and awareness. But it's only been really recently that it hit me that someone accused me, and then all of the mechanisms of what's possible began to become apparent. Because look, my wife was in a near fatal motorcycle accident back in September. You know, we've been doing just all kinds of medical stuff, and her day is very long, and with a traumatic brain injury, wants to rest all the time. And in this moment, I was just like, is this what it's like? Is this just average, ordinary people, not even police or administrative folks, just average folks giving you a hard time? That's frightening to me, Jesse.
It's terrifying. We are seeing a complete erosion of any sort of empathy in this country. And we know that as we trend towards an autocratic regime, it's going to be people who are least sympathetic to the general public who are attacked first. And that's certainly trans folks and migrants, but that's also people experiencing homelessness. We have underestimated how much people in this country just hate homeless people. In the past year since the Grants Pass decision, we've seen 320 cities introduce laws that make it a crime to be homeless. And over 260 of them have passed. None of those laws help people. None of those laws fund housing or supports. All they do is make it easier to throw folks who are experiencing a crisis in jail because they can't afford to pay rent in a country where half of people struggle to get by. These aren't solutions. All they do is make homelessness worse and make it easier to kick people while they're down.
Yeah. I shared my story because look, I understand, had I thrown a stink, who knows what happens now in this day and age with, all of the rules that we now have in place for people being angry in public, let alone being homeless in public. Anything on your side, anything that you've seen personally on how this ruling has affected folks? Anything?
I've seen so much. I mean, two tragic stories come to mind. In California and in Georgia, we know of people experiencing homelessness who were actually killed when the government came to use backhoes and other heavy machinery to destroy their encampments. In Kentucky, where they have a billionaire-backed anti-homeless law, we saw a woman who was in active labor get cited for sleeping outside, for violating the camping ban. The police didn't offer to help her. They didn't actually believe she was in labor, and she gave birth to a healthy kiddo later that day. But can you imagine being in labor and being told here's a ticket by the very people who are supposed to help you? And for me, I was in Deschutes, Oregon in May, when the Trump administration evicted nearly 200 homeless folks from the National Forest by threatening them with $5,000 in fines or up to a year in jail, all because they were sleeping outside in a city, in a state, and in a country that has no housing that people can afford. These encampment evictions are incredibly expensive. They're deeply traumatic. And most importantly, they keep people homeless longer. I believe that all of us want to solve homelessness, maybe for different reasons, but I don't think anybody wants to see people living outside. But this focus on these backwards, billionaire-backed laws actually make the problem worse. The only way we're going to solve homelessness is by connecting folks with housing and supports they need. And when we do that, we build communities that are healthier, that are more just, and that are more vibrant, and where everyone has the support they need to thrive.
I would like to agree with you. I really would. I'd like to agree that not everyone wants to take any joy in people's misery. But I got to tell you, recently I look at my Republican friends and I look at the leadership there, and I got to tell you, I don't know. I used to believe we were a country that wouldn't let someone die on the street. I used to believe we were a country who believed at least somewhat the Christian nation rhetoric. That guy that used to run around talking about feeding the hungry and clothing the naked and caring for the sick and the elderly. I used to kind of think we were that country, but I got to tell you, with over 200, I guess your numbers, with over 230 laws passed last year to criminalize homelessness, I don't know.
I do think these laws, and I know these laws, are deeply unpopular. In a recent survey from ACLU and YouGov, we see that over 70% of people from all parties, agree with us that we need housing, not handcuffs, and that throwing folks in jail or punishing them for being poor is not a good or effective solution. And although we have seen a tremendous amount of laws passed on the city level, we have seen nearly we've seen about 50 laws introduced on the state level that make it illegal to be homeless, and nearly 80% of those laws have been defeated. So when people are able to hear these stories about how these laws don't work and make homelessness worse, we can change things, we can make a difference, but people are so rooted in this belief that homelessness is a personal choice and a personal failing, and we have to do much better to educate people and help them understand that homelessness is caused by housing that's too expensive. And we know that for every $100 rent goes up, homelessness increases by 9%. Half of renters in this country struggle to pay rent. This isn't just about the 700,000 people who are sleeping outside right now. This is about the tens of millions of renters who are at risk of homelessness. And all of those statistics were before the White House and before the Republican Congress published their regressive, anti-poor, anti-worker budget. So we know that if this budget is allowed to pass, just like these anti-homeless laws, all they're going to do is hurt people and make more people homeless and keep them homeless longer.
Yeah, I've fought that battle here in my local community when we used to do our Hungry and Homeless for the Holiday events, because people have this idea of who the homeless are. They're all drug addicts and they're all lazy, and that's the narrative. But what I found, sadly, in our community, a lot of it was a lot of folks struggling with mental illness. And when the state closed the state mental hospitals and gave people nowhere to go, they went to the streets and then ended up, you know, going in and out of the jails. But the other one, and the one that, you know, most people are surprised by, are working people. People who work in your fast food restaurants, looking at low-wage jobs. Folks who, the car broke down and they lost everything. And it's really sad that we don't have a mechanism to help those folks.
Absolutely. To respond to many of those points, certainly the closing of mental health institutions contributed. But at the same time, the Reagan administration gutted tens of billions of dollars for housing. So at the same time as folks were being kicked out of mental institutions, we were seeing a historic erosion in housing that people needed. And unfortunately, it appears we're on track to hit another significant gutting of these social safety net programs. There's a new book out by a buddy, Brian Goldstone, called, I believe it's called, There's No Place for Us, but I could be wrong. So,
you know, I have a friend who, she's written a number of books on she's one of the big homeless advocates that I know. And she said, you know, in her view, the number one reason that people end up homeless is a car repair more than $400. And you stop and you think about that. In this country, where an enormous percent of people are two paychecks away from disaster, to have a government that's now saying, if you do hit that road, that bump in the road, if you do end up in this crisis, we're going to lock you up instead of helping you. Just, I'm still stuck with that. I know I shouldn't be. I know I should be going, what's the solution? But I'm still stuck with that.
And this isn't new, right? The Supreme Court made it a lot easier for cities and states to throw people in jail for being homeless. But these anti-poor, anti-vagrant laws have been around since the foundation of this country.
Sure.
We just find new ways to punish people who are poor, but they don't work.
Like putting spikes on the wall and putting dividers on the park benches and all of that stuff designed to make someone whose life is already uncomfortable even more so. So let me ask you this. Are there any places that are doing things right, that are doing things well? Anything that you would say, hey, this is kind of the model of what we should be doing? All of this stuff over here that we've just been talking about, this is not the way to do it. Is there a way to go, hey, this is what we should be doing?
Nobody's doing it perfectly, but there are certainly cities that are doing a better job. Newark is a good example. Some cities in Texas, Austin is a good example of cities that have changed how zoning works so they can build more housing, and cities that are focusing on getting folks support and housing that they need. One good proof point of this is veterans homelessness. We have seen historic reductions in veterans homelessness across the country because the federal government put resources into it, which shows that homelessness is not some intractable problem. It's actually not rocket science. If you get someone housing and you get them support, they don't live outside anymore. But for most people, they don't have, there's not enough funding to go around. And that's even before these budget cuts come down the pipe. But I saw it in DC where I was a homeless street outreach worker, that when folks got housing, they got better. They lived inside, they had an apartment, they went to the doctor, they reconnected with family. Their lives improved, and the lives of the community improves too, because everyone is healthier when we're all healthier. But unfortunately, it seems that the only thing that politicians can think of right now is throwing people in jail. And it just doesn't work. So we're really excited. 11 states have introduced a version of the Gloria Johnson Act, named after the same Gloria Johnson from the Johnson versus Grants past Supreme Court case. And this legislation says cities can't arrest, ticket, or otherwise criminalize homeless people unless they give them an adequate, decent place to go. And next week, this law is going to be introduced in Congress by Representative Jayapal and Frost, called the Housing Not Handcuffed Act. And we hope this jumpstarts the conversation and forces elected officials to refocus on real solutions to homelessness, like housing and support, because we know housing is too expensive for most people in this country. And until we address the fact that right now housing is treated as a commodity that rich people can use to get richer instead of something that we all need, we're going to keep having people living outside, and we're going to keep having millions of people one paycheck away from homelessness. But it doesn't need to be like that. We can solve homelessness, and we can actually have a country where everyone has housing that meets their needs. And when we do that, we're going to be a safer, healthier, and more just community.
Yeah, as we found out during the pandemic, there's a way to end childhood poverty. Give parents money. There's a way of doing this. We've just chosen not to. In fact, we could easily solve these problems. But again, we've chosen to enrich a minority of folks in this country, our billionaire class. And we're doing it again with this big, beautiful nightmare of a budget bill that they're going to ram through. They're going to cut Medicaid. They're going to cut into Medicare. They're going to go after taking, they're going to take food out of the mouths of children so that we can give massive tax cuts that never, never, let me repeat, never trickle down. But those are the priorities.
And it's all connected, right? There's a billionaire named Joe Lonsdale out of Austin, Texas, who made his billions at Palantir selling facial recognition technology to ICE and the government to deport migrants. And Joe Lonsdale started a think tank called the Cicero Institute, based out of Austin, which is peddling these racist, backwards, anti-homeless bills in states across the country. He is friends with Elon Musk. He is friends with J.D. Vance. He is friends with Peter Thiel. And he had a meeting at the White House a few weeks ago. These billionaires are the same people behind these budget cuts are behind this push to make it illegal to be homeless. And we are very clear that we need housing and support, not tax cuts for the rich and handcuffs for the poor, because most people are so much closer to sleeping outside than they are to becoming a millionaire like Elon Musk or his friend Joe Lonsdale.
No, it's an excellent point. And I go back to, you know, my high school civics teacher, when I asked him, how do you know which party that you're going to align with? And his answer was, you know, all these years later, still spot on. You know, Republicans are for big business, the very wealthy, limited government. They're not going to do much for you, but they're not going to be always too deep in your pocket. Democrats are for, you know, big government, big social programs for the poor. And you folks in the middle, you're going to pay for both. So decide which one you're closer to. And I find that to be, you know, as I get older, an excellent explanation.
And the Democrats have not been good on this issue, right? I was out there when Joe Biden and his National Park Service evicted about 50 homeless folks from the McPherson Square Park in D.C. The Biden administration was not good on the criminalization of homelessness. And we see, you know, Gavin Newsom out in California, who is positioning himself as the anti-Trump and is certainly doing a good job responding to ICE, but he's actually taking the same pages from the Trump playbook to respond to homelessness by encouraging cities to make it illegal to be homeless. We need a political system that works for the many and not for the few. And instead, we see politicians of both parties passing these laws that make homelessness worse at a time where more and more people across the country of all parties and of no party struggle to pay rent. The lack of affordable housing is, in my mind, the biggest driver both of inequality but also of hardship for most people in this country. Yet politicians are not talking about it in ways that they should. I wonder what a campaign might look like if they focused on ensuring that everybody had a safe place to live.
No,
I think that would be a galvanizing political campaign.
And ensuring that, you know, people don't, when they lose their job, don't end up homeless, their standard of living doesn't fall, that we have a reasonable living wage, that we have health insurance and education for our children, all of these things. I wish there was a party that really focused on that wholeheartedly. I do. I want to talk about the Housing Not Handcuffs Act. What outside of saying that you can't criminalize homelessness. What else does this do? Or is that just it? We're just saying you can't criminalize it. Is there anything to help, move in a policy direction? Is there a way to help, funding for states to do things, anything?
Yeah, so this bill is introduced in direct response to the Supreme Court ruling last year, and it's very simple. It says federal agencies can't criminalize homelessness. That's it. It's very simple. It doesn't impact what states can do, although states are introducing similar versions of the same legislation. But you're right, this bill in and of itself isn't going to solve homelessness. So we're hoping what happened in Miami happens across the country. There was a federal ruling that said Miami couldn't throw folks in jail for experiencing homelessness. And Miami, because they still were a tourist district and wanted people to come downtown, decided, well, if we can't throw folks in jail, we got to do something. And they expanded the supply of housing and shelter, and they reduced homelessness by half. That's what we want cities and states to do. Unfortunately, the consent decree that was prompting Miami's action expired. They went back to throwing folks in jail, and homelessness went back up. So we see, again, these things don't work. But if politicians don't want to see folks living outside, the only way they're going to meaningfully address homelessness is by funding housing and support. And that needs to happen at the city, state, and federal level. Unfortunately, for the first time ever, we have a HUD secretary who's asking for the funding for affordable housing to be cut. That's not going to help anybody. All that's going to do is to create more people experiencing homelessness and place this burden further on cities and states who are already strapped and already struggling with the demands that they're met with. We have to fundamentally change how we do housing in this country. Housing should not be something that you can only afford if you're wealthy. Housing is a basic human need. We all need a place to sleep. We all need a place to wash up. And when we ensure that everyone has the housing that they need, we are healthier, we are safer, and we're better for it.
There you go. Jesse, I appreciate you taking some time for us, explaining and walking me through all this. I appreciate it. Hope you'll come back if and when this bill passes, and keep us up to date on what's going on.
Absolutely. And check out our website, housing.handcuffs.org. We're going to have a bunch of information about the Housing.Handcuffed Act up in a few days, so folks should tune in and check it out. Thank you so much, Rick.
I appreciate your time, Jesse. Jesse Rabinowitz, Campaign and Communications Director there at Homeless Law. Check out their website, homelesslaw.org. Want to hear your thoughts. Have you experienced homelessness? Have you been harassed, intimidated, any of that? I want to hear the stories. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1971. At 2:51 a.m., Battalion 12 Chief Leo Najarian of Los Angeles heard that there had been a tunnel explosion. That February, a 6.5 earthquake had killed 65 people in the area. Now it seemed tragedy had struck again. Just the night before, Chief Najarian had been called out to the same address. The Lockheed Shipbuilding and Construction Company was digging a tunnel over a mile long for the Metropolitan Water District. Chief Najarian had been called out when four workers were injured due to a minor explosion. He had found that the workers at the site were not testing frequently enough for methane gas. One spark from a tool could touch off an explosion. Leaving instructions to test more frequently, he left and spent the next day worried. So when another explosion alarm came from the same address, he rushed to the scene. There he found the second explosion was much worse than the first. Workers were trapped 5 miles into the tunnel. Rescue workers attempted to reach the trapped miners through a vent shaft near their position. Paul Badgley, a miner at the scene, was part of 4 rescue attempts. He described the heartbreaking effort, stating, quote, "The first time we went in there, I could hear the guys hollering for help. The third and fourth time, I couldn't hear them. It's a hell of a feeling not being able to help them when you hear them hollering." 17 workers lost their lives. In the aftermath of the tragedy, the Lockheed Company was put on trial and fined heavily for their negligence. California passed stricter mining and tunnel laws and established a state occupational safety and health administration. 19 Los Angeles firefighters were awarded the Medal of Valor for their bravery. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter @laborhistoryin2.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Isn't it amazing? I mean, honestly, that communities across this country are trying to criminalize the downtrodden. I mean, that's the part that gets me. And I guess it goes back to my religious upbringing. I grew up in the Catholic Church in the 70s, where peace and social justice were still the focus. We hadn't gotten to greed and abortion yet, they were greedy. Let's not get carried away. But, you know, the idea of helping in the community, of not allowing laws to be passed to criminalize people who are we're kicking people while they're down. That's basically what we're doing. And understand, homelessness shouldn't be a crime. It's a crisis rooted in our systematic failure to address anything that we, the people, need. And instead of what we're getting from a lot of my Republican friends, especially, is, and look, there are Democrats who are just as heartless because, hey, got to stay in office. And it's, you know, we don't want those unsightly people. We should be doing something positive. And I've been saying for years, you know, we've got to be investing in affordable housing. There's no reason that you can't have housing developments for working poor and working class people. We build these giant McMansions, we build these huge developments, and what do we get? Nothing for poor people. No moderately sized little bungalows like my grandparents' generation built. So what we need is we need to build affordable housing, and that can only happen through government programs. Understand, you know, you look at the fabulous 40s and 50s and into the 60s, that was built off of government investment, massive amounts. So we need to invest in housing, absolutely. Expand rental assistance, emergency shelters, supportive housing. You know, in Denver, as I remember, they've got an old warehouse that they turned into a living facility for people who have little rooms, and they're all the support services you need. There's a gym, there's all kinds of stuff to deal with people where they are. But we need more than just temporary solutions. We need actual housing. And this is where I thought Kamala Harris, you know, made a mistake and going, oh, we're going to give people $25,000 to buy a house, their first time home buyers. No, that's, again, easily divided. I was like, build houses and put people in them. We've got to have policies that are going to help heal our communities. And that starts with jobs. That starts with, if the private sector can't or more likely won't create enough reasonable paying jobs, the kind of jobs that you can live on, then the public sector has to. There's a lot of stuff that needs to be done. There's a lot in the care economy we should be doing. That you could pay people to make a living, to be able to put food on the table, keep a roof over their heads, and not end up homeless. But we're not going to do that, because there's no profit in it. And that's the sad reality. We've been sold on the idea that greed is good and the one who dies with the most toys wins. And the sad reality is it's never us. It's never the working class that gets the most toys. We're the ones who pay for it. And for me, in this moment, I'm disgusted by what I see coming out of Washington. And I hope other people are looking at Republicans, you know, the family values people, the Christian folk. And what they're doing is, well, immoral, unethical, wrong. Throw the word in there. I thought that they stood for something. I know. You got to pull yourself up by your bootstraps, right? Isn't that the argument they make? It's disgraceful what they're doing. And they should be called out on it. It should be one of these scenarios where we're talking to people and saying, look at these folks. Look at how immoral they are. Shame. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Do you have an idea? Is there somewhere in your community that's doing it right? I've seen some places with those little tiny homes. It looks cool as you know what. I'd love to hear it. Are there things out there that we could be passing along as best practices? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Miss any portion of the program, podcast. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick at rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap, WCFW HD2 Chippewa Falls, W228 EP Eau Claire, and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper. A partial verdict has been reached in the federal sex trafficking and racketeering trial of Sean Diddy Combs. The jury was not able to reach a decision on racketeering charges. CBS's Jerika Duncan reports.
The juror note said that there were some jurors that had unpersuadable opinions, but the judge instructed them to deliberate some more. They've only been deliberating about 12 and a half to 13 hours. Remember, they just got the jury instructions yesterday and started deliberating at about 11:30, 11:40 in the morning.
Jurors return tomorrow morning to continue deliberations. Brian Koberger, the man accused of murdering four University of Idaho students in 2022, has accepted a plea deal, according to a letter sent by prosecutors to the victims' families. CBS's Andres Gutierrez with more.
Tomorrow, Brian Koberger will stand in front of a Idaho judge and change his plea to guilty to four.